I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life, and see if I could not learn what it had to teach, and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived. That, of course, is a famous quote by Henry David Thoreau from his book Walden. And seems apropos. Been reading a lot of Henry David Thoreau out here in the woods. Because when you have this much time by yourself, you do tend to examine life in a way that you wouldn't normally otherwise. I mean, yes, if I die one day, if it's here, out here on this land, there might be some questions as to whether or not I actually lived. Because what is living if you aren't remembered by anyone? Maybe someone will remember me, despite the situation we're in now in America, too. You know, one time I remember in America 1, when I first moved to Los Angeles, I was staying with a friend, and he lived kind of close to the Hollywood Boulevard, or whatever the fuck it was called, where they had the stars in the sidewalk. The stars where it said different famous people's names. And I went for a run, and I ran down, and I'm telling the story just so you know that I used to run. I was a real big runner, very in shape. But I ran on along the stars, the sidewalk. The Walk of Fame, is that what it's called? I can't even remember. But I was running, and I was seeing the stars, and I was like looking down. You're not really supposed to look down when you run. Proper running form would have you look forward. And have your chest open and leading with your chest and run and landing on your toes, not in your toes, but the ball of your foot. That's proper running. But I was looking down in this situation because I wanted to see the names of the famous people. And I got to tell you, most of them, I'd never heard of them. I'd never heard of a single one of these people. And it made me realize, you know, it was interesting. The Hollywood Walk of Fame, you know, the stars in the sidewalk, that's reserved for people who are well-known in their field, and most of them well-known to the world. But at least they're known in Hollywood. They're known as, I mean, because not everyone on there is a celebrity, obviously. Some of them are directors or musicians or, you know, other things that they did in the world of Hollywood. So you don't expect to know every single person, but there were so many that I'd never heard of, and it was because they had long died, you know, and they weren't famous or known now in that time. They were known back before my time. And it made me realize, like, even the famous people get forgotten after a few generations. No one remembers. I mean, there's just a handful of people that are remembered for generations. Jesus being one of them. Obviously, he's your top historical figure. If you don't remember him, you're going to hell. Shakespeare, Henry David Thoreau, he's still remembered. He was alive a long time ago. And don't ask me what the years were, because I won't get that right, and I'll be embarrassed. But I feel like it was the 1800s, but I could be wrong. It's been a long time since I was in college and had to know those things. But anyway, I've been thinking a lot about legacy and, like, how do you live beyond your death, you know? Or is that just something not to worry about? You were here for a moment and you tried to shine your light in the little way that you could. And then when the light went out, you just went out. Maybe you got born again into another form. Maybe you were dissolved into stardust again. We all return to where we came from, the ultimate Big Bang, or whatever the fuck you want to say. Or maybe you go to actual heaven, like real heaven, where it's just like Earth, but it's heaven Earth. And there's a shopping mall, and there's people, and everyone that died before you is there to welcome you, and it's all physical. Maybe there's a real heaven like that. I don't know. But in terms of legacy of what you leave behind, I don't know. I don't know what that is. Never had kids. What does it mean when you don't have kids? Who remembers you after that? Who's a guaranteed going to remember you? it makes you live differently. It makes you make sure that people, that you're in people's lives. Young, you want younger people to remember you. So you got to get in with some kids, and you can't do it in a predatory way or you'll go to jail. You know, you can't be a creeper, but you got to get around some kids, you know, if you don't have your own, if you want to be remembered beyond that, unless you're some sort of Shakespeare type figure. And I wonder what Shakespeare thought. Did he know that he was going to be remembered this far in the future? I can't imagine. I don't know. Well, he was a man, and I feel like men, they think they're going to be remembered by generations just by nature, because they're so, their egos are so out of control a lot of the time. But yeah, anyway, these are some of the things you think about when you live alone and you don't talk to anyone. Another thing I've been thinking about, and this is going to move on into my memory from America One here, is the age-old question, are women funny? Did we ever figure that out? I thought we had back in, you know, like 2017, 2018. I was like, oh, it's obvious now that women are funny. But then every time something would come up about women in comedy, or I got into a Twitter fight with a bunch of idiots, they would always resort back to, well, you must not be funny because you're a woman. You must not be very successful as a comic because you're a woman. And they would still rely on these old stereotypes. And I actually think that a lot of people believed that for a long time. And I wonder now, you know, back in the designated bubble zone, especially the comedian bubble zone, where the comedians, of course, I definitely tried to live in the comedian bubble zone. Just a little history here, a little backstory. My first choice for my designated bubble zone, when we all found out that we had to go live in them, my definite first choice was comedians. I'm going to go live in the comedian DBZ. That's who I am. It's most of my friends. It's my world. Why would I not go join them? We're like-minded. We've had a similar life experience. It makes total sense. Well, it was great at first, you know, and I think a lot of comedians were thinking, oh, we're going to get to live in Hollywood because we're part of Hollywood. But it turns out the Hollywood DBZ was for 10s. Maybe you could get in if you were a 9, maybe an 8.5. If you were married to an 8.5 and you were a 3, you got in. But comedians aren't 10s. I mean, obviously. So we didn't realize the level of attractiveness that you had to be to get into the Hollywood DBZ. So comedians, we were like, okay, we'll go live in, you know, Victorville or whatever, further out in the desert. And it was nice at first. We were laughing a lot. You know, you can imagine living with a bunch of comics. There's a lot of joking around happening. But I'm not one of those comedians that likes to be on all the time. I like to be serious. There was a point where I was like, could we just chill out with the bits? Could we just stop for one fucking second? I don't need to yes and, you know, while I'm eating breakfast, okay? I just want to eat my goddamn hash browns without you trying to do a bit about hash browns and, you know, the Frasier theme song and how he listed weird items. What was the items? It was such a weird song. But anyway, comedians loved making fun of that shit. And I mean, it was just a point where I was like, can we just fucking stop? Like, I just want to be a normal person here. And there are a lot of comedians who like that too, that are, you know, turn off and turn on. And so there were like-minded people there, but I just got tired of it. And I felt like I didn't quite belong. To be honest, part of it was that I never did Conan. You know, every single comedian had done Conan, and I still hadn't. You know, there were literal 9-month-old comedians who had done Conan, and I hadn't done it yet. And I just felt, you know, that was sort of my white whale. I'd never done Conan. It was just like, what the fuck? Seriously, some of these people were born at a time when like I was already ready to do Conan. They were babies and now they've done it before me. So there's a lot of compare and despair in the comedian DBZ, and it really wasn't working for me. So I started to feel like there was too much competition and a lot of, you know, it just, for some reason, I just never felt like I fully belonged. A lot of roasting. There was a lot of people roasting each other all the time, and I never liked that. I'm too sensitive for that. Back to the question at hand, are women funny? You know, in my opinion, yes, women can be funny. Just like men can be funny. Some men are funnier than other men. Some women are funnier than other women. Can women be comedians? Yes, obviously. So then, now that we've established that, the next question is why, you know, and this, I'm speaking of back around 2017, 2018, why aren't there as many female comics as men? And that was something I was really interested in back then. I was, because I kept having these conversations that ended up being really circular, where a guy, you know, you'd go, hey, why weren't there any, why was there only two female comics on a lineup of 50 men at this particular comedy festival? That sounds bad. That's not good. How did that happen? How did you let that happen? And the answer to that usually is, whether it's by the festival itself, the booker, or from men who seem very invested in this, who aren't comics, or they're like younger comedians who haven't figured out that they need to shut the fuck up in these situations. The answer would be, well, the reason there aren't as many women on the lineup is because there just aren't as many women to choose from out in the pool. In the pool of comics who are ready for this festival, that's the ratio. The ratio you see reflected on the lineup is the ratio of how many women are doing comedy. This is the argument I always heard. Now, cut back to, I think it was 2015, I was at a festival. A booker was there from a different festival that I had publicly criticized for this very reason. I had tweeted one time like, hey, oh, you're 11% women. I did the math on it and I was like, that's not okay. Like, really? And that was early enough in my career. It was at a time in my career where I was a little bit afraid to post something like that. You know, feminism wasn't as trendy as it was later on. At the time, and I knew just from reactions I would get in conversations with my peers, other comics, that being a feminist comedian in terms of, hey, being a feminist about female comedians and about the ratio and about getting more representation was not popular. But I didn't care. I was mad and I said something. Cut to this festival. That was before that. Cut to this festival. And we're at an after party and the booker, this guy who I didn't know, even know who he was a booker from a different festival and I didn't know it was him. And I thought he was another comic and I was like, oh, are you a comedian? And he was like, no, I'm actually the booker of blah, blah, blah. And he looked at me and I was like, oh, hi, how are you? And he gives me this look and he goes, I just wanted to let you know that we are, and he kept saying we, and I'm like, who is we? It's you. He's like, we aren't mad at you for that tweet from last year. Like we're okay with it. We would welcome you into our festival. It's okay. And I was like, I wasn't worried about it. Like, wow, there's a nighttime bird out there. What's he doing? Go to bed, jerk. Anyway. He says this in the most condescending, patronizing way. And it was almost like how you hear how an abusive person will go, I have a gun, but I'm not going to use it on you because I'm so nice. And it's like, but wait, that is you threatening me. It was sort of in the same tone, obviously not the same, but it was sort of in the same tone of like, hey, I know you did something bad and I'm just letting you know I'm fine with it. And it was just so shitty. And so I'm amazed looking back. I'm like, oh, that was a turning point where I grew some guts in that moment. I grew into the woman that I am, and I stood up to him and I said, you know what? I said, what if, and I don't know why I said it, but I go, what if next year at your festival you booked half women? And I knew this would provoke him, but I didn't know how upset he was going to get. He got really upset with me and he was like, what do you mean? That would be wrong. That would be immoral. I can't book half women. That's wrong. And I said, why is it wrong? Who cares? And he goes, well, that wouldn't be fair to the men. And I was like, well, what do you mean? He goes, well, that's not reflecting of how many women there are out there. There's only so many women and so many men. And so if I unfairly give more women spaces in the festival, then that would be affirmative action, which I don't believe in. And then he later told me that he got into college because of affirmative action, because he's a quarter Hispanic. And I was like, what? Okay, anyway, it benefited him, but he doesn't want it to benefit anybody else. Also, what do you mean a quarter Hispanic? Like, or I don't know. I mean, he maybe said it was his last name. I don't know what it was, but it was just really weird. Point being, I stood up to him and I said, you know what? What I asked him point blank, what do you think the ratio is? It suddenly dawned on me in that moment that we were talking about math. You know, we were trying to break down this conversation about women being represented in festivals to simple math. Well, it's simple math, Sarah. There's only 10% women doing comedy. So that's how many get it on the festival. And I thought, do you really know? In that moment, I asked myself, wait a minute. I don't know if that's true. I've always just kind of given in and gone, well, I guess you're right. That is how many women are doing it. And I would always go back to, well, that's because we're discouraged from doing it because there's less women being represented and da, 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 and we don't try as hard and it's a boys club and you go to the open mic and you get felt up by another comic and you never go back. And I'm thinking of all these reasons, which are real things, which discourage women from moving forward in comedy, which, you know, we knew that. But then it suddenly dawned on me, there's another layer to this, which is how many women are actually doing this? And do we know? Do we really know the number? Because if this is about numbers, we should probably know the real number. And he goes, well, I don't know. And I said, well, what is it? 10, 20, 30% women? What do you think? And he was like, well, given the shows I go to, probably 20%. And I said, but do you really know that? Did you make a spreadsheet? Did you make a list? And he's like, no. And I said, has anyone ever done that? And he said, no. And I said, okay, so we can agree that the number, the ratio, is arbitrary. We have chosen it, and it's based not on science. It's based on anecdotal, your personal experience and your own bias, which we all have bias. You know, maybe you don't notice as many women because you're not looking for them. Maybe you don't go to shows that book a lot of women. And so you think that's the representation. And I said, if we can agree that it's arbitrary, then why are we arbitrarily doing it in favor of men? Why not arbitrarily nudge it towards 50% and make it fair for everyone? He's like, well, I need to know who the women are. I just don't know where the special... And he kept going, show me the special, the really special female comedians, really special. And I said, well, I actually have a list on my website. I had recently made a list of every female comedian I could think of, because that was another thing that had frustrated me over time, which was every time this conversation about are women are funny would come up, people would go, websites. And I was excited for these things. I liked them, but it would be like, you know, a different website, you know, Paste Magazine or Jezebel or BuzzFeed or, you know, whatever. Whenever these controversies would come up and kind of bubble up into the media, they would respond with, here's 10 female comedians you should definitely know. These 10 women prove that women are funny. And it would kind of be the same 10 women over and over again. And sometimes, if I was lucky, I rarely would, but sometimes I would get included on these lists and that felt great. But sometimes I'd be left off of it, which, you know, obviously you get a little sting. You're like, why wasn't I included? No one likes me. I'm going to fail. You know, that's a separate feeling. But you get these lists out, but they'd be very repetitive and they were sort of not very adventurous. You know, it'd be the usual suspects. And so then you'd get this idea that there were these only these 10 women. And so I thought, what if I made a list of every female comic I could think of that I could find? Famous, not famous, just starting out, very successful. And I put it all into a list. And it over the years, I kept adding to it. And I mean, it was up to like 700 names or something at one point. It was crazy. It was a lot to keep up with. But in the beginning, it only took me like 30 minutes to come up with 200 names. And it was just, there's just so many. There were so many female comics that I was like, So I'd made this list when I had this conversation with this dickhead booker. I'll call him Dickhead from now on just to be, to make it easier. So Dickhead was like, just show me. I'm kind of doing an impression of what he was like. Show me the special female comics, Sarah. Show me. Who are they? And he goes, can you send me some names? And I said, no, that's literally your only job is to find good comics. Don't rely on me. Do the work. If you really care, you do have to put effort into this. If you care about representing more women, then you need to actually research and find them, look for them, dig them out, because they're there. He was like, well, show me the great. And I said, go look at my list. And he goes, but who on this list is good? How do I know? And I said, Google them, you lazy dickhead. Fuck you, man. It made me so mad. I was like, I'm not doing this for you. I already did enough just by giving you the list. I've already done you such a huge fucking favor. Do the work. Google them. Find a clip of them. Literally spend one day looking up every comic. Like, you're that lazy that you can't do that? Anyway, and I love how he kept saying, I just need someone who's special. Like, does he ever speak that way about men? No, I guarantee he never did that. Anyway, at one point he like kind of patted me on the head and he goes, do you want some weed? You seem to be getting pretty worked up. He was so condescending and I was so upset, but I held my own and I was like being kind of sassy with him. But I wasn't getting too emotional, which was really hard for me. And finally I just said, this is something that, if you want it, you can have it. If you booked half women on the festival, you would be considered a hero probably. And it would be really good for you, but because you're just stuck in this old way of thinking. Anyway, the conversation ended. I went to my hotel room and I just broke down into tears and I couldn't sleep. But it was a turning point. Like I said, it was the first time I stood up to a person in a position of power. And I had just enough power at that time to be able to feel comfortable to do that. But it was a big moment for me. And I even followed up with an email to him where I really laid out my thoughts in a more clear way. And I said, I just hope that you will do the right thing and you'll be on the right side of history, because this is an exciting time and it would be great for your festival and great for your audiences, because audiences want variety. They want different, new, fresh voices. That's how comedy actually works. Unexpected works. So get in there and do it. He never wrote back. Fuck him. Anyway, I think his festival is pretty irrelevant now because it doesn't exist. We got rid of comedy festivals. We decided they were really wasteful and they were usually really disorganized and it required people leaving their bubble zones and it was a big mess. It was too much red tape to get all the paperwork that you would need to go to a comedy festival somewhere else. But the point being, the main reason was just because the festivals almost never pay anyone. And the comedians were like, we're done. Fuck that. A lot of lessons were learned. I want to say one more quick thing. I could talk about this for hours, but I just want to say one more quick thing about the women in comedy debate. You'd think that kind of put the end to it for me. I stood up to one guy and now I know what to say, but it didn't. Because that question of the ratio always came back around. And I started tracking back then. I started tracking Comedy Central, like how many specials they gave, half hours they gave to women. I started tracking any kind of big lineup, like what the ratio was. And what I found from like 2011 forward, Comedy Central would give more and more specials to women percentage-wise every year. And I found that to be so exciting. And I would tweet about it every year. And sure enough, every time I tweeted about it, I would get in trouble. I would get yelled at, not only from men who were like, oh, I guess the specials aren't getting as, I guess they're getting worse now that there's more women, you know, dumb shit like that, which I just dismiss because I'm like, you're obviously of lower intelligence if you think that women naturally aren't as funny as men. We've moved on from that. You need to catch up. When you press people who challenge you on this, like there was a point where Netflix started putting out 15-minute specials, and they put out the list of the people that got it, and it was half women. It was truly the first time I had ever seen a 50-50 ratio on a major network or festival lineup like that. 50-50, rare. Beautiful. I was so excited. I tweeted about it. And then I start getting tweets. Gosh, you know, what does this mean? Should the Comedy Cellar and the Comedy Store start booking 50% women on their lineups? And I was like, yeah, why the fuck not? Who cares? And I got a lot of questions about the ratio again. Well, if the pool of women doing comedy is less than men, then they should have less of the spots. And it's like, if you think this is about math, then you tell me what's the real ratio. What is it? And they never can answer that. And I just find it interesting. And I actually did at one point create a list of every comedian, male and female. It took me a really long time and it was really exhausting. And I was like trying to be super inclusive, like looking up club lineups all over the country and all the major markets, getting friends to send me lists of every comic they knew, trying to make sure I was getting as many in as possible so that I could figure out once and for all how many women are doing comedy and how many men. Now, I'm not going to tell you what the number was because it wasn't 50%, but it wasn't 20% either. It was somewhere in between. It was probably more than you think. It was definitely more than I thought it was going to be. And it was really interesting because what I came to find out was that nobody really knows, but at least I have a better idea than most people. I actually did some math and it is more than your dumb 10% or even your 20%. And what about all the years that that ratio was unfair to women? How about we make up for it? How about we give 50-50 for a while just to even it out? Who fucking cares? If there's enough people. That's the thing you don't understand. Like when they give out 16 specials, there were probably 50 comedians who were qualified. So who cares if half of them are women? Who cares if all of them are women? Who cares? If everyone's qualified, give it to them. Anyway, who cares? Of all the qualified people, there are plenty to choose from. And it's not just women along a gender line. There's also your LGBTQ comedians, your comedians of color. I personally believe from a business standpoint, comedy is better with more variety because you want to mix it up. And hearing different people's stories is funny. I love hearing people that I don't understand talk about their, maybe that I don't understand, but that I'm not like, people who aren't like me. I love hearing about their life. It's funny. It's surprising. It's refreshing. It's good business. Anyway, it was back then. But when I posted that Netflix thing, the ratio conversation came up. And I never bring up the spreadsheet that I made all those years ago because I knew that the moment I published it or said the number, then that would be the new number. And I would love for it to be 50-50. That's basically the breakdown of the population. So why not have our comedians be that breakdown? I wouldn't want to set a new status quo that was under what it could be. I also knew that people were going to pick it apart and go, this isn't scientific. You left out this. It's biased, blah, 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 blah. And I just didn't want to deal with it. I did it more for myself so that when I had these conversations, I could always just rely on the fact that we really don't know the real ratio. And so we need to stop having that excuse. You need to stop saying, well, it's just because less women do it. It's way more complicated than that. And the more opportunities we give marginalized voices in comedy, the better we all will be. I mean, this is a speech for the ages that no one will hear. But it's something I'm extremely passionate about and always have been. And you know what? I just want to make one quick point, just from a selfish place. Maybe a little braggadocious of me to say this. I'm not sure. I don't know. It actually might end up sounding like I'm tearing myself down. Let me just say it. You know, when I posted all these things about the half hours and the Netflix specials, these are all things that I tried out for and that I got rejected from. So there's always, whenever I post those things celebrating women getting more representation, and the lineup overall of all the men that got it too, always funny people. I always had a sliver of pain when doing that because I didn't get the thing. I didn't get the thing that could change my career or boost my career or check that off the thing off the list that I had never gotten before. And whenever I posted those things, there was this under layer of like, of, you know what, I'm going to deal with this by rejection, by celebrating something that I know benefits me in the long run. It was my way of kind of dealing with it. And I know sometimes in my younger days, I wouldn't celebrate other people's success because I felt that it was taking away from my own. Especially as a woman in comedy, you felt like you were in competition with every single other woman. And it made me behave in a negative way, or at least think in a negative way for many years, you know, being trained to think that way. And by celebrating other women's success, it helped me kind of deprogram that thinking of the other woman is who I'm in competition with. No, I'm in competition with all the comedians, and I needed to really start thinking that way. And so this was a way of rethinking and laying down new tracks in my brain and going, you know what? We will celebrate other women. Even if we don't think all of them are funny, or maybe we think some of them are total bitches. And there's only been really one time that I have publicly criticized another comedian that is a woman, or any comedian, but especially a woman. And that was Eliza Schlesinger. And I'll just say it because it was all out there for everybody to see. And, you know, I have some regrets about how that all went down. I wasn't mean to her, but a lot of people piled on. And I knew that that was a possibility. And I wasn't stupid about Twitter. But she and I did have a private conversation that I think we heard each other, and at least somewhat after that. But I didn't tweet about it because I felt that that was private and between me and her. Maybe I'll talk about that on another episode. I feel like I've gone too far down, and we can talk about the Eliza thing some other time. Maybe I'll just leave those breadcrumbs there for whoever might ever hear this so that they get excited about a future episode, and I'll just keep you hanging on. Okay. That felt good, you know? But now it's time for What's Happening at the Cabinin'. Hey, everybody. Welcome to What's Happening at the Cabinin'. I'm Sarah Schaefer. I wanted to give you a little background on the title of this podcast, Loner at Coy Wolf Creek. Obviously inspired by my favorite book, which I opened the entire podcast series with, which was Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. Love that book by Annie Dillard. So it's a little play on that. But also, on my little plot of land, I was out in the woods one day, and there's a creek on my property, and I love creeks. I've always loved creeks ever since I was little. I used to live on a creek. I lived like I spent all day in the summers from 10 a.m. till sundown out in the woods, far away from my house. I mean, that was back when your parents let you actually leave your house and go into the woods. And we'd play in the woods all day long, and I'd play with my best friend, Leslie Gray, and we would take our marble composition books into the woods, and we'd sit on this branch over there was this tree that had a real gnarly trunk that sort of was twisty and parallel kind of to the ground, and went over the creek, and we'd sit on it with our legs dangling over the creek, and it was this beautiful setting and the sounds of the babbling brook. I love it. And we'd sit there and we'd write books. We called them books. We were like writing fantasy novels, like in our marble composition books. And I don't know if I still have any of those, but those were some really happy times. Those are summertime memories as a kid. I loved living out there in those woods, and we'd take out snacks with us, and it was just so fun. And then right around sundown, you'd hear her mom, just the faintest, "Girls! Girls!" And then you'd run back inside and you'd have dinner. So anyway, I love a creek, and I'm lucky to have a creek in my zone. And I was out there a while back, and, there's no name for the creek. Kind of the history and the man-made names of things kind of disappeared when I got my plot of land. I didn't know what it was. I just knew I was near the Appalachian Mountains. And, this creek, I was standing on it. I loved walking along it. I still do. I do it almost daily. And one day I saw, you see wildlife around, deer and squirrels and owls and birds and hawks and shit like that. But once in a while you'll see a special animal. And I saw right standing across, and I knew they were around. I'd seen them, here and there, but this one was like a close encounter with a coy wolf. And if you don't know what a coy wolf is, towards the end of 2000s, scientists started noticing that there was a new breed of animal on the East Coast. And they tested it, and it was part coyote, part wolf, even a little bit of dog DNA. And what they determined was, because of human destruction, because of human beings just literally defecating all over the fucking earth, the wolf and coyote population kind of dwindled, and in desperation, they started fucking each other. And maybe some dogs got mixed in there too. They had a little orgy with all the different dog species, wolf species. There used to be this commercial for dog food that was like, for the wolf inside your dog, I can't remember what the brand was, but they made you think that if you fed them this dog food that your dog was going to become a wolf, which I don't know why anyone would want their dog to become a wolf, because they are really intense predators, vicious wild animals. So anyway, this new species, they were able to identify a new species called the coy wolf. And they were sort of like a little stumpy looking wolf dog thing. They look kind of silly, but I came into contact with one on the creek, and I decided to name the creek Coy Wolf Creek, because me and this coy wolf had this moment. She and I just looked at each other and just kind of had a quiet moment of staring at each other, and there was a moment of, the only way I could describe it would be cosmic plane speak, where the two of us were speaking to each other from the very essence of our life, of our being. We didn't have to say any words, but there was just this communication and an understanding that we were neighbors and friends, and that I would protect her, and that maybe she would protect me. Look, am I adding in a little fantasy to it? Am I hoping that this coy wolf would maybe be my dire wolf? Sure, I'll admit to that. But it was a wonderful moment, and cosmic plane speak is something that I try to engage in as much as possible. And I had started doing that back in America One after reading a book by David Dark called The Sacredness of Questioning Everything. And it's a book, I think, I wouldn't recommend it if you're not religious, or, I mean, maybe if you're open to religious stuff, you can read it. But it's kind of a book about being able to question your religion, specifically Christianity. And he was kind of speaking to people who were very rigid in their beliefs, and that, the idea that, how weak is your God if your God can't handle questioning? But anyway, he talked about this thing called cosmic plane speak, and he referred to it as sort of when you communicate with someone in a way that shifts their awareness, that makes them see things in a new way. Oftentimes that would be done through poetry, through jokes, through music and song. And sometimes it's just the way two people or two beings, in this instance, communicate. And it's cosmic plane speak, and it's beautiful. But anyway, the coy wolf and I, we have an agreement, I think. And ever since then, I gave her that creek. I said, this is your creek. You know, I'll come down here and enjoy it, but it's yours to drink from, to play in, and I am just here to take care of it for you. And that was a great convo I had with that animal. And it makes me think, like, I was going to talk about this earlier, but I decided to save it for now, which is, I think I found out in my late 30s that I have a personality trait, a personality type called highly sensitive person, an HSP. And what it is someone who, it's, yes, you're a sensitive person. Yeah, I mean, obviously, I'm a very sensitive person. My feelings get hurt really easily, which is why I'm probably in a loner zone. Anyway, a highly sensitive person is beyond just being, oh, I get my feelings hurt easily. Like, that's not really what it means. What it means is you're someone who is very sensitive to stimuli, sounds, smells. Like, I always was struggling with things being too loud. It would physically hurt me if TV was up too loud. If people were talking too loudly, I would avoid restaurants that were really loud. I remember Yelp had this great feature that said, you know, ambiance noise level. And I thought that was really important to always check the noise level, because if a restaurant's too loud, I ain't going to it. Which kind of made me not cool, but because usually the cool places were louder. Highly sensitive people also tend to feel, this kind of is on a spectrum of being towards being an empath, which is also another personality trait, which I don't think I was fully an empath. I think that was a little extreme for me, but I do have traits of an empath. But highly sensitive people tend to feel others' pain or feel pain more deeply, have a very rich inner life. Being alone is something that you prefer a lot of the time. So it is linked to being introverted. I always think back to an example of when I was very young, when in my family we got spanked, like spanking was a thing. And when I normally didn't do anything I would get spanked once in a while, very rarely. And I hated it. I didn't like it. But I remember when other siblings got spanked, I would lose my shit. I would be so upset, inconsolable. My mom would have to send me outside. I mean, I'm thinking back on this. My mom had 4 kids. She's in the middle of chaos, you know, because when you get to the point where you're spanking your child is being an actual demon, and you need to strike the demon out of them. So think about the setting in which a child is acting like a demon, and you've got to fucking handle that shit. And your way of handling it is spanking. Say what you will about spanking, but that's what my mom did. And I don't, you know, I'm a nonviolent person, partially because of my status as HSP and because of what I'm about to tell you, which is when other people would get spanked in my house, I would lose my fucking mind. I would be so upset. She had to send me out of the house. So in the middle of screaming at the other sibling, she'd be like, Sarah, get out. I have to spank her. You know, and it's like, I just feel bad that I think I actually brought spanking to an end in my household, because I would be so mad, and just because I could feel the sound of someone else getting hit. It just was too much for me. And so I felt that pain. And so that is a little bit on the spectrum of being a highly sensitive person, perhaps empath, but empath means that you're really sensitive to other people's moods and in a room. And it's, I think I'm not quite that, but an HSP, I definitely am. And it helped me really understand more. When I figured that out, it was like, oh, that helps me understand why I used to use the metaphor, which I didn't realize what I was describing was this thing, being a highly sensitive person, which is I always felt like I was a walking open wound, that my whole skin was just, I had no skin. You know, you think, oh, thick skin, thin skin. I had no skin, just raw nerves. That's what I felt like I was in the world. And that everyone else was a mummy. They had not only skin, but then they had bandages all the way around them to keep anything from hurting or touching them. And when you're the one with no layer of protection, you're kind of at a disadvantage because other people are going to brush up against you and it hurts. They're not going to understand why you're so hurt because they don't feel it. And they've got a front on and they have a thick skin and, you know, maybe they have their own issues. I'm sure they have their own problems, but that's how I always felt in the world. And then years later, when I found out about highly sensitive people, I was like, oh yeah, that would be me. And I spent years up to that point trying to not be an HSP and toughen up. And I kind of hit a point where I was like, you know, maybe I need to relax a little and accept the fact that this is just how I am. It doesn't make me, there was a lot of issues, like, you know, with significant others, it would always be like, God, it's not that loud. Why do I have to turn it down? And I'd just be like, because it physically hurts me. Or, you know, I'd be like, what's that smell? Oh my God, I smell onion. And I'd freak out because I'd have to get rid of the onion smell. And he'd be like, I can't smell anything. And he'd walk, like, we did a test one time. I smelled onion, like bad onion, like old onion. I walked into our apartment in LA on the first floor. We had a first floor entrance and then walked upstairs to the main apartment area. And I came in, I smelled onion. The moment I opened the door, I was like, it smells like onions in here. And he's like, you smelled it from down there? And he did a test from downstairs all the way up to the trash can to where he smelled the onion. And he was 2 feet away from the trash can when he smelled the onion. I was all the way in a different part of the house downstairs. So when you are sensitive like that, you tend to, you also tend to be like, really bothered by smells that other people, they would be bothered too if they detected it. So anyway, that was just a little thought spiral I just went down, and that's my luxury of being here. I can say whatever the fuck I want and nobody can criticize me. So deal with it. Anyway, guys, I love you, whoever you are. I love you so much. Bye.